Welcome to PaleoCast. This is Caitlin. I am PaleoCast's newest member, and you may recognize me. I did an episode a little while back with Dave where he interviewed me for, I think it was episode 52, about my master's research, which I did at the University of Bristol looking at melanin preservation. And I also covered a couple of conferences this year, the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology Conference and the Geological Society of America Conference, so you may recognize me from that as well. But this is my first proper sit-down interview, and I'm really excited to bring it to you. I got a chance to sit down and talk to Dr. Larry Whitmer, and I got really lucky because he essentially just showed up at my doorstep. I am doing my PhD at Virginia Tech, and he came to give a talk. So I had the opportunity to sit down and chat with him for a bit. He had to run off to do his talk at the end, so I could have kept going on and on for ages. So maybe at some point in the future, we'll have the opportunity to get him back on the show. Before we get started, I want to remind you that the crowdfunding site for the Virtual Natural History Museum still has a few days left. If you haven't checked it out already, you can find more information on that at our website. This is a project of Dave Marshall's, and it's a really ambitious, exciting project that will incorporate technology to bring natural history collections to the classroom. And this is a great opportunity to access natural history collections around the world, but it also is really great for students at schools that wouldn't have the opportunity to travel to a natural history museum otherwise. So if you haven't donated yet, please do so. Check it out at the website. If you don't have any cash to donate, like if you're a grad student or something, sharing the link on social media is also a great way, a little way to do something to get the word out there. So I thank you very much for checking that out. And up on the website also is this episode. So we have images that Dr. Whitmer gave us about some of the research that's going on in his lab, and also some interactive skulls that you should definitely check out because they're so cool. So yeah, I hope you enjoy the episode. Whitmer is a professor of anatomy and a Chang professor of paleontology in the Department of Biomedical Sciences at Ohio University, where he and his lab study the functional morphology of vertebrates. Hi, Larry. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Hi, Caitlin. Thanks for having me.
So I want to just get started by asking you, how did you become a paleontologist?
I'm not sure I ever wasn't a paleontologist, as far back as I can remember, at least in my head. But I didn't actually touch my first dinosaur fossil anyways until I was in grad school. But I grew up in the Devonian of upstate New York. I'm very old. I grew up in upstate New York where there was lots of Devonian. And so I was sort of a rock hound kid. And so I collected invertebrates as a hobbyist, as a kid, and went to lots of different states and I collected invertebrates, but I was always kind of jonesing for vertebrates. And so, although all my degrees are in biology, I was really drawn to the past. And so, in a sense, I've been sort of stuck in this zone of being both in the past and in the present in my research as well.
So your undergraduate and your graduate degrees are in biology?
Yep. So bachelor's at Cornell University in biology, and master's at the University of Kansas, and a PhD, actually technically in cell biology and anatomy, at Johns Hopkins Medical School.
Okay. What would you be doing if you weren't a paleontologist?
That's a good question. There have been times that I've wanted to be a musician, like a paid musician. and I've sort of done that. I was in bands in college and stuff like that. And that's really hard to make a living at. People thought getting a job in paleo was tough, actually being a working musician is pretty tough too.
What instrument do you play?
I play guitar.
Okay.
So, And I still do all of that. I don't have time to really be in a band and gig. Although I'd like to, but I'd be a really crappy band member because I'm just too busy to make rehearsals and stuff. But in my dreams, I'm probably, you know, in bands.
Yeah. So, what would your ideal genre of music be for your band?
I really like blues.
Oh, cool.
American blues. So I do a lot of that. And that's still what I play. It sounds good when you're playing by yourself. Mm-hmm. Sounds even better with a band, but it sounds okay by myself.
Cool. That's awesome. So you're a professor of both anatomy and paleontology. How does that make your point of view and your objectives different than someone who is just a paleontologist?
I think it helps a lot. It certainly has sort of matched, the research vibe that I have, which is sort of this notion of reconstructing soft tissue. The reality is that, I think I may see fossils a little differently. You know, when I look at a skull, there's blood dripping out of foramina, and I see eyeballs in the orbit, and to me, it's all about fleshing it out. And I think part of that comes from my training as a biologist, but also throughout my graduate training, I became trained as a human anatomist, mm-hmm. and I've been in med schools now approaching 30 years. Wow, I'm old. and so, including my graduate training at Johns Hopkins. Mm-hmm. And so being involved in teaching human anatomy is, I think, amazing training for paleontology, because in human anatomy or any kind of anatomy, you're looking at all of the different anatomical systems. So you're looking at not just the bones, but everything else that's wrapped around those bones. Mm-hmm. And for a course that is really focused on one species, like human anatomy, you necessarily get into incredible depth. Mm-hmm. I sometimes say, and usually I'm kind of pissed about it, is that I actually know human anatomy way better than the anatomy of the animals I actually work on.
Yeah.
I know it top to bottom, toes to top of the head. For people, I can tell you all about branching of the arteries and the pancreas, and I'm not even sure I could find the pancreas in an alligator.
Right.
I probably could, but. But there's great utility in knowing one animal really, really well. So I know the anatomy and the physiology of this one animal. It's not a random animal. It's most of my family and friends are that animal.
Right.
And so it's kind of useful information for that. But I actually think it's made me a much better vertebrate paleontologist, just knowing this one animal really, really well. And I think that's true for the students in my research lab as well, because they are similarly trained mm-hmm. in human anatomy or medical anatomy even. So it's it seems like kind of an odd mix, but it's not as odd really as what a lot of people might think. There's lots of vertebrate paleontologists that are actually teaching human anatomy in med schools.
Right. So in order to understand what extinct animals were like, you study living animals. So you're quite familiar with humans, but you also study animals that are closely related to the fossil animals that you study. What can they tell us about the evolution of extinct animals that we can't get from fossils alone?
Yeah, well, in some respects, parsing out group membership on whether you're extinct or extant almost seems kind of arbitrary. Particularly when we live in a time when things are becoming extinct left and right, thanks to us. This notion of evolution means that all of the Earth biota are embedded in this phylogenetic history. And so if I'm interested in dinosaurs, which I am, I'm in a sense almost, in my mind, required to know everything I can about them. And part of that everything actually relates to their extent relatives. And obviously the key thing that the extant guys have is their actual biology. So they actually have soft tissues. They still have behavior. They still have physiology. And so by, in a sense, asking the right questions about the past, We can find answers in the present. We can look to the modern realm to help us understand what the bones are trying to tell us. So at a very fundamental level, a lot of the research that we do in my lab exists at the very fundamental level of looking at a crest on a bone and saying, what is that all about? What made that crest? Is it actually a crest that was pulled up by maybe a muscle? Or is the crest actually not even really a crest? Maybe it's an epiphenomenon left by excavation of the two areas around it, mm-hmm. leaving a crest in between. The explanations for that anatomy are two very different things. And that's the kind of stuff that I want to know. So super fundamental. What soft tissues are making those bony doodads that we see in the fossils? Because then we can go a step up and sort of say, like, once we've got the soft tissues, okay, so what do those soft tissues do? How do they relate to the functioning animal? And then we can potentially sort of say, okay, well, that's how it functions. How might that relate to behavior? And we can kind of keep going up this inverted pyramid of inference that I talked about once that leads us to actually asking larger and larger questions. But all of these, in some cases, actually reduce down to what actually made that little thing that we're looking at on the bone. And very often, I can't answer that just by looking at the fossil bones of an extinct animal. I need the animals that still have all of those soft tissues, all of that biology still around. So in most cases, the questions that we ask stem from the fossil record. They're often questions like, what's up with that? Mm-hmm. Why is Camarasaurus, why does it have such a big ass nose? Something interesting must be going on there. To answer that question, I can't answer that just by looking at Camarasaurus. I have to look at all kinds of other animals. Birds are the most relevant. Crocs are then the next most relevant, at least phylogenetically. But sometimes you can even jump out to mammals and find analogous structures that might be comparable. And so it takes a little bit of creativity to try to formulate questions that can be answered.
Okay, and in your work, in your research, you use a lot of CT scanning. Can you explain the process of CT scanning and how you reconstruct anatomy that isn't preserved in
sure.
these fossils?
Yeah, CT scanning has been around for a long time. We sometimes even joke about the fact that the Beatles actually invented CT scanning. and the connection there is the guy, Hounsfield, that actually did actually invent CT scanning. Was actually part of, he did it when he was working for the part of an organization whose parent corporation was EMI, which actually was the publishing company for the Beatles.
Wow.
And it was actually the proceeds from the Beatles that actually helped float the research of the broader company. And so the Beatles kind of invented CT scanning.
Yeah.
And so that's my connection to the Beatles, and I'm going with it.
Okay.
But CT scanning uses x-rays. It's a very common hospital modality basically look inside, because it has x-rays. From us, from a paleontological standpoint, using x-rays allows us to maybe peer through rock that's encasing a fossil, or peer through the fossil itself into what's going on inside the fossil, like what's going on inside the brain cavity. And so when I and most people got interested in CT scanning, we mostly just wanted to see what was going on inside. And we still do, looking at slices to see what the internal anatomical structures are like. But what's been happening in recent years is that we've also been using CT scanning as a way to basically transfer an object, a fossil or whatever it happens to be, into a 3D digital environment. It basically digitizes it in 3D. And the beauty of CT scanning versus, say, laser scanning is it translates all of the anatomy, the internal and the external anatomy, into 3D coordinate space. And so where a lot of the sort of the science has now moved into is in this area of 3D modeling. And so we in our lab and other folks are also using CT scanning or surface scanning. For us, it's mostly CT scanning to bring objects into a computer environment where we can fix them if they're distorted or broken, or clean out the rock if we want to look at the nasal cavity or the brain cavity. And then we can potentially start to do things with it. We can actually reconstruct some of the soft tissues, but we can also start to run other kinds of analyses. And so lots of people are doing sort of engineering kinds of analyses, and my lab does a lot of those as well, like finite element analysis. One of my students, former students, he's finished up, Jason Burke, has been looking at modeling airflow using an engineering approach called computational fluid dynamics. And so, and really sort of the sky's the limit nowadays. In that once we're now in the computer environment, you can actually start to run simulations, you can start to test hypotheses, you can, in a sense, sort of run crash tests to see how strong structures are. The kicker for all of these things is we also need to do this other part of that, which is to validate those methods. So not only do you need to bring it into the computer and start to do analyses, you actually then need to actually go back out of the computer to make sure that the kinds of analyses that you're doing are credible and actually have experimental validity. And so that's actually something that we've seen. It's sort of interesting as how the field has progressed. As soon as we sort of were able to jump from 2D kinds of studies into 3D, folks started doing lots of different kinds of stuff. And then about 10 years ago, people sort of said like, yeah, we're doing all this stuff, but what's it mean? How credible is it? And so now we've actually, a lot of labs, including ours and many others, are now starting to go back and make sure that the approaches that we're using are validated, meaning that they actually match up with what happens in the real world, because you can do anything in a computer if right. you want to. Hollywood has shown us that they can do anything. It's become incredibly important for us to be able to validate the kinds of 3D modeling that we're doing.
Great. So you mentioned how you can do these reconstructions and then make inferences about physiology and then even make inferences about behavior. So what sort of inferences have you made or can you make about animals besides how they move around?
Right. And actually how they move around is one of the things we haven't done a whole lot with.
Okay.
The locomotor apparatus, we haven't done that much with. We seem to be stuck in the head. Actually, I don't have any apologies for that. There's a lot going on in the head. It's where the brain and sense organs are located, and all the sustenance comes in there, the feeding apparatus. There's even lots of behavioral stuff, lots of sort of headgear, horns and frills and visual display organs in the head. So, we've been doing lots of stuff. I mean, we've had major projects on lots of different systems, such as the brain and jaw muscles. And so we've done lots of studies on brains, trying to understand the structure of the brain and how that may relate to certain behaviors, because you can sometimes see certain components of the brain that might be more involved with vision or the sense of smell, and we can make some comparisons. It's all fairly broad brush kinds of comparisons, and actually it's always good to remember that when we're trying to interpret the past, that we try not to paint a picture with too fine a brush. We can actually get into trouble if we start to try to make, in a sense, inferences that are more detailed than we probably should. And so in a sense, when I say, you know, we're trying to paint with a broader brush, we're trying to understand things that we can actually know. There's lots of things that we would like to know, but we need to stick, as scientists anyways, with what we actually can know. And that means that we often need to paint the past with a broader brush. I can't tell you that T-Rex had the sense of smell that could, you know, sense a carcass 6 miles away or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I could suggest to you that T-Rex may have had the sense of smell in T-Rex may have been more important than it was in a different kind of dinosaur, because the neural structures associated with the sense of smell were larger in T-Rex. I can't give you absolutes. I can give you comparisons.
Mm-hmm.
That's a broader brush. Those are safer statements that we can make. So we've done things like that. We're moving into some really exciting areas that relate to physiology. particularly with things that pertain to or might relate to regulating brain temperature. Mm-hmm. And so all dinosaurs have famously small brains, and I've been part of the group that's shown just how small they are in some cases, it's still their brain. And sort of this ironic thing about, you know, we've had this debate about whether dinosaurs were warm-blooded. The reality is that most dinosaurs, most large-body dinosaurs, or ridiculously large-body dinosaurs, many of which were, would have, if anything, been too hot. So for some of these dinosaurs, many of the dinosaurs, we really shouldn't be looking for ways to keep them warm. We should be looking for ways for them to deal with the high heat loads they would have had. Mm. And the neural tissue is very sensitive to temperature. And so we've actually been looking at mechanisms for potentially having selective brain temperature regulation, brain cooling. And so the work I mentioned before with Jason Burke in my lab, looking at modeling nasal airflow, some of that is relating to heat exchange. And even more directly, one of my former doctoral students, Ruger Porter, did his dissertation on patterns of blood flow in the head that was actually looking at sites of heat exchange. And so what we're trying to do is we're not looking at how dinosaurs got big. That's a really interesting topic unto itself. What we're trying to figure out is how dinosaurs could survive being big without basically frying their brains. They would have been in constant danger of overheating. And so, at least as far as the brain goes, we feel like we're actually zeroing in on some mechanisms for them to have been able to sort of deal with that. And a lot of that gets into straight up modeling. So we're actually modeling the anatomy, mm-hmm. but we're also trying to model the physiological correlates of that anatomy.
So how do you study blood flow in the brain? Is that something there's some sort of evidence for in the bones itself, or is that from soft tissue reconstructions?
All of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ultimately, the fossils have to speak for themselves.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we're just, you know, making shit up. We try to minimize that.
Yeah.
Make it zero if possible. And so, yeah, we have, there's lots of evidence for blood vessels in bones. Not all blood vessels actually run right next to the bone, though. And if a blood vessel isn't running right next to the bone, we don't necessarily know about it. And so that's part of the reason why it was a doctoral dissertation level research project, to really understand patterns of blood flow in extant animals. Because part of what that gives us, if we understand sort of phylogenetically, what are the blood vessels that dinosaurs should have as archosaurs or as diapsids, then we can pretty much feel confident they have them, particularly if we find some osteological evidence for them, some grooves and canals in the bones. And the reality is we do. And so there are blood vessels, for instance, that might be crossing through the orbit, the eye socket, that aren't running next to bone. But very often what we can see is we can see a part of that blood vessel that we know in the back part, attach it where it's next to the skull, and then we pick up that another groove for that blood vessel in the front of the orbit. And in a sense, what we can do is we can then connect the dots, because we know what that artery is, because lizards have it, mm-hmm. and pigeons have it, and alligators have it. And so we can start to put those pieces together. And what's exciting is not only can we establish the pattern and start to name the blood vessels, but we can see, once again, in a comparative context, who has big ones and who has small ones. Because it turns out that dinosaurs, just like other animals, will be emphasizing different parts of their anatomy. And so we can look at blood vessels that are large in sauropods that are smaller in theropods. And so they're doing something different. And it turns out that animals use blood vessels to shuttle heat around their body, which we actually know from our own experience. We can actually become flushed when we're too hot. And that's a way we're actually shunting blood to the skin to try and radiate out the heat. And so lots of animals, and we have absolutely no reason to believe why dinosaurs weren't like that, shuttled heat around their body using blood vessels. And so we sort of feel like we're really zeroing in on some of these anatomical and now physiological mechanisms for dinosaurs to potentially deal with the high heat loads that they would have had.
awesome. What is the most amazing thing you've ever seen on a CT scan? Or one of the most amazing. I'm sure you've seen a lot of really cool stuff.
Yeah, I have seen a lot of cool stuff. And we'll stick to animals because there's all kinds of things that people put inside themselves. And so we won't actually go there, but I've seen some pretty amazing things that somehow find their way inside of people. So, I mean, we've had the real pleasure and privilege of being able to study through CT scanning lots and lots of very special animals. Not just dinosaurs like T-Rex and all kinds of stuff, but lots of extant animals too. Everything, you know, ranging from rare Indian crocodilians, gharials, to rhinos and giraffes and ostriches, lots of things like that. One of the coolest ones was actually, it was mostly cool because it was a historical specimen. It was Hypsilophodon, which is a little dinosaur from the Wealden Formation of the UK, of England. It was actually the holotype, which was named by Thomas Henry Huxley, Darwin's bulldog. And when I was in the Natural History Museum in London, I wanted to borrow that specimen so that I could study it. And do CT scanning of it. And Angela Milner, the curator, looked me in the eye and she sort of said, "You realize this has never left this building since Thomas Henry Huxley brought it in." And I sort of gulped and she let me have it. And so when we did the CT scanning of that specimen, it was the kind of thing that just gave you chills. I mean, sort of like, you know, a field paleontologist that's, you know, brushing away the sand and see something that's amazing. It's the same feeling. But in this case, I was seeing something that Thomas Henry Huxley would have loved to be able to see. Yeah. He couldn't see inside this thing. And so some anatomy is special. Some animals are special. In this case, the object was special because it was so important. Hypsilophodon was very important actually in the history of dinosaurs as well, because it was one of the early dinosaurs that was named. It was one of the dinosaurs that showed that not all dinosaurs were big. It wound up being, even though it's not a theropod, it wound up being very important in Huxley's formulation of the debate on the origin of birds. Although he was more interested in the, not so much the origin of birds, but the position of dinosaurs within vertebrates. And it turned out to be birds. Mm-hmm. We read it as origin of birds. He was actually trying to place dinosaurs, which is the flip side. So that one was just a tremendous thrill, in part because of what we were doing and the object we were studying.
That's amazing. Okay, so your freezer is a thing of legends. And I was just wondering, what are a few of the things that you have in there right now?
We've got lots of stuff in the freezer. We've got everything from, you know, a mourning dove that crashes into, you know, the window in my house, to specimens that have really come from all over the world. So we've got all kinds of crocodiles. There's a big, you open up the door and there's a giant 8.5 foot Siamese crocodile that greets you as you open up the door. There's a couple of rhinos in there. There's giraffes. There's dozens of different kinds of birds, like albatross. But we have lizards and turtles and just a huge diversity. Seals, manatees, mostly heads. We don't have the whole animal for a lot of these. I mean, like some of the birds and smaller animals we do. But we're sort of a head-based lab, and so we sometimes just get the head. And it's just it's a tremendous resource for us, our walk-in freezer. And we've got lots of other freezers too, but our walk-in freezer is sort of a special place for us.
All right, so I think we're going to have to start wrapping up because I know you have to run. But my last question is there anything going on in paleontology right now that you're not involved in but you find really interesting?
Yeah, actually, the stuff that's really the heart of paleontology is, which is field work. I'm actually not doing that anymore. I did it earlier in my career, but sadly, the questions that we're asking are not ones that are answered by me traipsing through the Badlands.
Yeah.
And so I missed that, but I mean, I travel the world looking in museums. Actually, the field work I do is actually looking at the extant animals, trying to understand structures that we're looking at. But the reality is that field work in paleo is really at a peak. It's happening all over the place now. I mean, it's not just, you know, Europe and Western US, which it was for, you know, dominated that for so long. It's really every continent. This big expedition just left for Antarctica with some of the stars of vertebrate paleontology. And so it's just exciting to see what's going to come down the pike. And the reality is that sometimes, even though I'm not out in the field, I get pulled into those projects because I'm sort of a hired gun that looks at you know, skull anatomy. And so sometimes I get drawn into these. And so, yeah, I mean, maybe field work isn't the most, doesn't sound like the most cutting edge thing, but that remains one of the core parts of paleontology and what gives us the diversity that allows me to do what I do.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programs. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at @PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.